Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Narrative First podcast. This is episode number 7, Making Things Uncomfortable for Your Main Character. Welcome back to another weekly edition of Thoughts on Story Structure and Story Analysis. I'm your host, Jim Hull, curator and dramatica aficionado, and the guy who writes and runs everything at narrativefirst.com, where story is always king. This week, getting back into the groove of things after a three-day Memorial Day weekend. Didn't see any movies, still catching up on Orange is the New Black. Right now I'm in the third season, not quite as good as the first. I hear it's a rough one getting through the third one, so we'll see how that goes. The last few weeks at Narrative First have been extremely busy. Everybody seems to really be into the Narrative First roadmap, which is where I basically take your synopsis, outlines, treatment, whatever you have, and go through it and discover what the Dramatica story form is for your story. And then I create the outline for it, which is basically about 28 to 32 sequences. If you're interested in the Narrative First roadmap, go to narrativefirst.com/roadmap to learn all you can about it. There is a 2 to 3 week lead time now for all roadmaps. It seems like we hit upon something that a lot of people want. You know, they've been working with Dramatica for a really long time, or they've been working with their story for a long time, and they're still not quite sure what it is, you know, what they're missing, what they're getting wrong. And just having somebody who is deeply versed in the theory, who's been, you know, working with it for 20 years, just to have them go over it and look through and see what it is that, you know, is at the heart of their story has been really beneficial to those who've actually gone through the process. Right now we're working on one that has a fantastic overall story, perfect overall story through line. There is a bit of a main character through line, but the influence character and relationship story through lines just aren't there. There's hinted at, and I think there's an attempt for a certain character to be the influence character, when in reality it's actually somebody entirely different. And that'll be really interesting to get back with that writer and let them know, you know, this is actually what it is that you're telling with your story. So again, if you're interested, that's narrativefirst.com/roadmap. And because we're so busy with all the roadmap action, we didn't have time to write a new article this week. What we have instead is an old article from our vault section. If you're not aware, the archives are broken up into articles, which is where all the articles from 2010 on are. There's the analysis pages, which is basically our look at different films. You have thoughts, which are basically just the daily blog postings. And then you have the vault section, which is everything before 2010. You know, I started this site in 2006 after I got really tired of writing about animation. My history is as a character animator for Disney and DreamWorks. And I had a blog called Seward Street somewhere around 2004, one of the first animation blogs. And it was great writing about that. I obviously like writing about things that I'm passionate about. But after about 2 years, there's only so much you can do writing about animating. Much more fun and more interesting to actually animate. But at the same time, you know, I'd been working with Dramatica for 10 years or so, and I knew how powerful it was for story and how the films that I were working on simply didn't have functional narrative. I mean, if you want to see broken films, you basically see anything in DreamWorks between Shrek 2002 and How to Train Your Dragon. And on down the line, each of those stories, the narrative has something majorly wrong. You know, just to kind of scratch that itch, I started to develop a blog that was called Story Fanatic. That lasted till about 2009, it was called Story Fanatic up until 2013, I believe. And then I switched it over to Narrative First once I actually left Dream. So this is one of the first articles I wrote way back in 2007. As with anything to do with Dramatica and story, it's timeless. It's called A Good Impact Character Makes Things Uncomfortable. You want your main character to grow believably? Have someone come into their lives who makes things uncomfortable for them on a personal level. Main characters generally start out a story with everything worked out. Although they may have some deep-seated problems, as far as they're concerned, everything is hunky-dory. Until, of course, that pain-in-the-ass impact character comes along and ruins everything. So you'll notice this article uses older, outdated terminology from traumatic. The impact character referred to in this article is now known, perhaps more accurately, as the influence character. Those of you who were around during Dramatica's inception, was 1994, will remember this character by a completely different name, the obstacle. And the name has been changed throughout the years to make it more approachable and more understandable to writers. A lot of writers felt that the obstacle character was always the antagonist. And while that is sometimes the case, as with villains like the Joker in the second Dark Knight film, it's not always like that. And frequently, it's separated from the actual antagonist. So why was it called the obstacle character in the beginning? In short, this character acts as an obstacle to the main character, continuing on with their misguided justifications and influences him or her to reconsider the way they do things. So the main character comes with some kind of baggage, some kind of justification for what they're doing, and they would just keep going on and on and on until they meet this impact character, influence character, obstacle character, who stands in the way and says, hey, buddy, you've got something to deal with, and now they can't do anything but actually start addressing those issues. And then that's what happens in the story, act by act. You tear down those justifications until they get to a spot where they're like, oh, this is where my problem is. And then they can either turn off the targeting computer or they can scream out freedom and have their guts ripped out. In my first case study of Breakfast at Tiffany's, I made an argument for why the Audrey Hepburn character Holly Golightly was not the main character. Instead, I offered some reasons for why the George Peppard character, Paul Verjack, was a better match for the main character. So why does Holly work so well as an impact character? Paul in the beginning. When we first meet Paul, everything seems to be okay with him. While we soon discover that his method of earning a living is a bit socially unacceptable, he seems to be fine with it. He justifies being a male gigolo with the idea that it provides him the resources and the time to write. Only he hasn't written anything in over 6 years. And who is it that finally brings that to his attention? Who is it that shines that light of awareness upon his dark and hidden justifications and makes his life uncomfortable? It's Holly. Even though they are falling in love, Holly wastes no time in calling Paul out on the life he has created for himself. If he is a writer, why hasn't he written anything in 6 years? And why is there no ribbon in his typewriter? It seems to Holly that if Paul really was what he says he is, he'd at least be able to type something. Holly has become an irritant to Paul. She's the one that clues him into the fact that the only thing keeping him from writing is himself. In doing so, Holly has become Paul's impact character, a constant reminder of all the things he has hidden away from himself. And while this 1967 romantic comedy cannot be more different than the dark and brooding 1992 Clint Eastwood Western Unforgiven, this idea of the irritating impact character exists there as well. We ain't bad men. Eastwood's money thinks it will be relatively easy to kill a couple of cowboys responsible for abusing a prostitute. His friend and longtime writing partner, Ned Logan, played by Morgan Freeman, thinks otherwise. If you take a look at their first meeting, you can see how money, although not completely sold on the idea, was still ready to go without too much trouble. Ned, not as eager to put his life in danger, asks Money how long it's been since he's fired a gun. Money reluctantly answers, a bit annoyed that Ned would even bring that up. When Ned tells him that if these guys had done something bad to him, he would understand, Money answers back that they've done jobs for money before. He goes on to tell Ned exactly what it is these guys did, exaggerating the event as to make it justifiable in his own head as well. But it's only once Ned brings up the memory of Money's dearly departed that things start to get really uncomfortable. She would not be happy with his decision to return to his old ways. The conversation comes to a dead stop, and Money gets up to leave. Keep it to yourself. Both Peppard's Paul and Eastwood's Money wish that their respective impact characters would just mind their own business. Deep down inside, they both know what they're doing is wrong, but it's not until that external view of themselves comes along that they really start to see what it is they're doing or not doing. All main characters should be so lucky. Question. Under our old name, Story Fanatic, we left space open for readers to leave comments and questions. Following is a question received in regards to the above article. Does this hold true for Steadfast main characters? Is it perhaps that they are irritant to the impact character? I hope so. That's the core of my current novel. So basically, this person was asking this whole idea of the influence character being irritant to the main character. Is the reverse true when the main character is steadfast? And I answered, in this case, Paul is a steadfast main character, and Holly is the change impact. So yes, I do think it holds. Holly is basically the irritant that forces Paul to shore up his reserves and plant his feet ever more firmly into the ground. But I'm sure that by the very nature of Steadfast main characters forcing change in their impact characters, you could think of it working the other way as well. I had mentioned last week that I would start my interview sessions with Melanie and Phillips this week, 5 minutes with Melanie. But we didn't have time to get everything set up, and I want to make sure it all sounds great. So we'll be starting that next week. In lieu of that, we're going to look at our analysis of 99 Homes. If you haven't seen it, it's a fantastic film. 99 Homes, a phenomenal thriller that pulls you in with its confident and complete narrative. Ramin Bafrani's phenomenal 99 Homes draws you in by means of a captivating and sound narrative, making the audacious actions of those preying on the disenfranchised all the more impactful. Like a separation, 99 Homes uses an everyday commonplace event as the background for an enthralling thriller, a thriller that excels because of its meaningful story. Main character and single father Dennis Nash, played by Andrew Garfield, finds himself driven from the only home he has ever known. Evicted and unemployable, Nash turns to realtor Rick Carver, played by Michael Shannon, for work. Nash is a man who will do whatever it takes to get a job done and whatever it takes to provide for his family. While this makes it easy for him to wade through a house full of literal shit, it also blinds him to the damage he inflicts by helping Carver to kick people out. Now, there are a ton of story points going on here. The fact that Dennis finds himself driven from the only home he has ever known, that is the main character through line of situation. So we get to experience what it's like to be in that situation. That's where the problem comes from. And his issue of security. So we're going to look at what it's like when you will do anything possible in order to keep up that security, to keep those defenses up. Going on to the next line, we have Nash turning to realtor Rick Carver for work. Here we have the story driver of action. All complete narratives are either driven by actions or driven by decisions. You're going to have both actions and decisions, but one will precede the other. So actions will either drive decisions or decisions will drive actions. So in this, it's a story driver of action and a main character approach of doer. All main characters, they're either doers or they're beers. They either prefer to solve problems externally, and then they can deal with stuff internally, or they prefer to attack things internally first, you know, by changing themselves, adapting themselves to the environment before they actually take action. Rick is a doer, and a doer in an action story means he's more willing to participate in the story, so he doesn't feel so much like a fish out of water. It feels like something that he's prepared to do. Now we have something a little more deeper. When we say that Nash is a man who will do whatever it takes to get a job done, you start to see his main character problem of process. And it's kind of hard to think of a character who has a character flaw of process. Like, most people don't even think of that when they talk about critical flaws or anything like that. But here, process, that's the mechanism, that's kind of the machinery, that's the motion, you know, as opposed to results. You know, these are the means. So if you think about, you know, the ends justify the means, so that would be somebody that's focused on results. Here, it's somebody that's just focused on the process, just like the means, getting that job done. And that's actually what creates a problem for him, because he doesn't see the damage he inflicts by helping Carver to kick people out. And here we have the overall story concern of doing. So problems in the story aren't created by somebody trying to grab treasure or somebody trying to figure out a great mystery. It's actually just the act of doing something, which is basically just kicking people out of their houses. That's where the conflict is coming from. And of course, you have story costs of impulsive responses. Those are the negative things that happen along the way when you're trying to solve a story problem. You have these costs that come along. You have costs and dividends. Here, the costs are the reactions, the impulsive reactions people have when they want to defend themselves and defend their homes that they grew up in. So we continue on with the analysis. Carver could care less, having figured out long ago that his path, as despicable as it may seem, was chosen for him. Carver doesn't see homes, he sees boxes, big boxes and little boxes. Regardless of what sob story he or Nash may hear the day of the eviction, the fact of the matter remains that these individuals borrowed money that they can't pay back. It's a system that can't be beat, only embraced. The house wasn't even the victim's to begin with, that's why they have to leave. Here we have some more story points here. The fact that Carver couldn't care less, that he feels like this job was chosen for him, is shows an influence character problem of determination. So it's already been determined for him, and he's not even going to reconsider that. That's actually what drives him. When he doesn't see homes, he just sees boxes, big boxes and little boxes. That's the influence character's unique ability of value. So in this story, the reason Carver is able to actually impact Nash is because of this unique ability of something to do with value, which means he doesn't value homes as much as Nash does. He just sees boxes, and that has a huge impact on Andrew. And again here, and this kind of ties in with Andrew's own problem, is Carver's thought that it's a system that can't be beat, only embraced. So again, here we have an overall story problem of process. So everyone's engaged in the process of evicting people or making money off of these people. Or you have everybody that was buying into the whole system and buying houses that they simply couldn't afford. And finally, we have the house wasn't even the victims to begin with. That's why they have to leave. Here we have the overall story symptom of unending and the overall story response of unending. And here we have the overall story symptom of unending and the overall story response of ending. So characters don't look at problem and solution when they look at overall story. They're really focused on the symptom and response. That's where their attention is focused. Because if they're focused on the problem, they would just solve it. But here, and in every other story, they just look at the symptoms. Here the symptom is unending. They want to stay in their house. And those who want to take it from them want to kick them out and end their residency there. So we continue on with the analysis. Nash looks up to Carver in what could almost be considered a father-son relationship, or at the very least, a mentor-mentee relationship. Propelled by the hunch that they both need each other, they engage in each other's services. The father figure manipulates and coerces the young man into thinking of himself as less the bad guy and more of a victim of circumstances. This is the life that has been chosen for them, so best not to read too much into it. So here we have story points that are focused on the relationship. And here, the thing that's bringing them together is this hunch, this intuition that they should actually be together. And that's what kind of wraps them around each other. And then you have the father figure manipulating, coercing the young man into thinking of himself as less the bad guy and more a victim of circumstances. You have the classic mentor-mentee, you're not thinking the right way, you need to think my way, relationship story through line of manipulation or psychology, a manner of thinking. And the relationship story concern of playing a role. So it's really, you know, what role are you going to play in this? Are you going to be a victim or are you going to be the person that wins? And that's where their relationship centers around. And then finally, the relationship story issue of thought, which is the issue between them is what they think of each other and what they're thinking of what it is that they're actually doing. And whether the other person thinks less of them or thinks more of them, it all revolves around thought. Back to the analysis, Carver's cold, calculated demeanor is the very thing that inspires Nash to action, challenging the hapless father to examine his motivation for aiding and abetting the power elite. Faced with the ramifications of his actions, his mother and son abandoning him, the father of his son's best friend holding the police at bay with a rifle, Nash finally gives up the fight and admits to his wrongdoing, thinking that this will somehow win the day and change things around for everyone. So here we have the influence character story points. We have the influence character through line of fixed attitude and the influence character concern of impulsive responses. So here, you know, his cold and calculated demeanor, his attitude is the thing that inspires Nash to actually move into action. Like, here's a guy that just knows exactly what he wants and goes and gets it. And it challenges Nash to re-examine his motivation for helping those out. And then when he finally gives up the fight and admits to his wrongdoing, here you have the main character resolve of changed. So he changed his resolve. He didn't remain steadfast. And the main character solution of results. So here he's owning up to what it is he's doing and putting out those results out there, feeling that that was going to actually make things better. But note how we are not giving the outcome of his change. The story outcome is left unanswered, save for some strange authorities approaching Carver and vaguely asking him to identify himself. Does this signify failure? Did Nash's change of heart finally expose Carver's nefarious activities to the point where they will be stopped? Or will Carver somehow be able to buy these guys out and continue on as he always has, which would mean a success story? Leaving this all-important story point to the imagination is often the death of most narratives. How then can 99 homes account for its critical acclaim? And that's where the artistry comes in. Carver needed to secure 100 homes in order to complete the deal. This last home, the one belonging to the father of Nash's son's best friend, was the 100th and last home they needed. Nash saved this one from the chopping block, but what about the others? The title contains the answer. Nash may have saved this one, but the 99? they still went through. Why else call the movie 99 Homes? It's a brilliant move by a talented writer and director, one that will go unnoticed by many, but felt subconsciously as a result of a solid story form. Carver approaches those authorities with the confidence of a man who knows he is not beat, a man who knows he will continue doing what he has always done. Nash feels great about what he did, but we feel strangely so. The combination of a story outcome of success with a story judgment of good marks this film a triumph, making it a celebratory event along the lines of Star Wars or Top Gun. Unfortunately, in this film, we celebrate the success of a bad guy. 99 Homes is a solid and complete narrative that deserves a place on many a best of list. The performances, soundtrack, and direction only compound the positive effects of a great story. Effective narrative gives meaning to the meaningless, a place to understand and comprehend the chaos of carelessness. 99 Homes does more than entertain, it inspires. Thank you for listening to the Narrative First podcast, and we'll catch you again next week.